With the test beam data, you got around to the point, I think, hopefully most of you, where you could at least plot things and could see that there was a relation between if... I will turn off video. You could see that there was a relation between three detectors that if one said low, then the other also said low. And that meant that it was for the same type of event, in this case, particles. And that these could then be used to sort of select that type of particles. And then for the third detector, quantify the detector in the sense of drawing a rock curve, finding out what value was actually best to use, what combination of values, and also to know just how good it is. So that was the that is the exercise. And especially for the once you've now managed to sort of make clean samples, I would today love you to take the move into saying, okay, if I use the Cherenkov and the calorimeters, then I can get clean samples. And I'm just going to ask you to take the video off, Norman, simply because I'm on a poor connection, or not the NBI high quality connection. Thanks. Well, if you get a clean sample of electrons and a clean sample of pions using the Cherenkov and the calorimeter, then look at the TRT and try to select events, make a mask that selects events with exactly, say, 35 hits. Could be 34, 33, doesn't really matter, but try 35, because there are many of those. Now, these are all particles that had 35 chances of making a high threshold hit. And then they have some probability of making a high threshold hit. And you don't know if the probability is the same or not. But if it is the same, then you should see a binomial distribution with capital N 35 and P some value, which is around 20% for electrons and around 6% for pions. And so I'd like you to test if the probability at each straw seems to be constant, the same for all, or if some straws have a higher probability and some have a lower. That is a binomial fit. And once you have the binomial fit working for electrons separately and pions separately, now you may try to do a fit with two binomials where the capital N is common and fixed, but where you have two probabilities and two normalizations to fit. Because in that way, you can actually, without knowing even what signal to expect from electrons and pions, know what is the fraction, or what, how many pions are there in the sample and how many electrons. So such a sort of global fit is very powerful. And I want you to have tried it just once. That said, I'm not going to introduce anything new. I will just talk about good things. And one of them is to finish the machine learning talk I spoke of yesterday. And the other is a little note on binning. So let's start on the machine learning talk where we got to last time. So here, well, I spoke about the different types of methods, boosted decision trees and neural nets. And now I wanted to show you some examples from the real world. And one of the examples I think is quite striking. It was a company producing bricks, and bricks needs quality control because many bricks are not of the quality they want. So they burn them and take them out. And then it was humans that were inspecting all of these bricks. And the humans usually discarded between 4% and 7% of the bricks. So a small but not insignificant fraction. And then they started to say, well, you know, let's take what's the color, the surface strength, different things in a very simple algorithm, and try to see if they could train it to spot the good and the bad bricks. And it worked reasonably well. But unlike the workers, sometimes they only discarded 2% and sometimes they discarded 30%. And to cut a, you might say, why? Well, how could that be? And here, there's a social effect in it, because it turns out that workers, if they only rejected 2%, then management might think that they were lazy. And if they rejected 30%, management might get mad. But here was an algorithm doing it. And it turns out that the strength of bricks has a lot to do with the burning of it. And since they're burned, a lot of them at once, it meant that if it was a really good burning, then you only had to discard very few, which for other reasons were bad. And if the burning was bad, then you had to discard almost a third of your production. And so from that reason, it worked quite well. The machine learning algorithm did not have the bias of or the problem with discarding many or few. It just went ahead. So another place using machine learning or suggesting it is called Crime Lab. And they were looking at who should go on bail in Chicago. And the problem, you want people to go on bail. You don't want them in the jail unless you suspect that they're going to re-offend. Now I'm being warned that my connection is unstable. I'm just going to put the chat on. And if I somehow do not come through, then please write immediately. All right. So they took all those who were up for bail and said, can we do better than the judges? And when the judges were judging people, well, 18.6% were re-offenders. But if the machine learning algorithm did it, it could get down to 14.9. And then Crime Lab said, you know, that corresponds to having 20,000 police officers, and that's a lot of money. But the idea of this is quite nice. The problem is that what does this algorithm take into account? Does it, for example, but do the numbers make sense without uncertainties? Well, it was a quite large number, so the uncertainties are small. I think the systematic uncertainties are much larger. But no, they didn't put uncertainties. And you should here at least think of how many did they check, right? Because if they checked 15, then these two numbers would be consistent. All right, that's mildly noted. The problem is, what if it takes skin color into account? Well, the cool thing is you could not feed it skin color, for example. What if it took your address into account? Well, you could not feed it that if you didn't want to. Or, as it turns out, there are other ways to make sure that it's not biased in some way. Another was heart attack predictions, because it turns out that your heart rate will change ahead of a heart attack often. And so that is a possibility. Flagging police officers if they are stressed and should be sort of taken off duty before they pull a gun in the wrong place. For ideas, I would say I have two that I've toyed with over the years. SCAT, Ministry of Taxation. I would say finding sinners in tax is an obvious machine learning problem. You have so much data, and you've already found, of course, quite a few who are convicted of tax evasion. And so if you say, look, try to show me all the cases that looks like this case and rank them, then I don't want the machine learning algorithms to send out the letters for court, but at least you could give a prioritized list for all those whom you think are suspicious. and start at the right place. And also see if suddenly something big changed, like a few British people through companies dragging out, 12 billion Danish crowns, could be another. Anything suspicious, right? Something that is not standard, and looking up companies if they exist or, you know, anything. And I think SCAT, as one of the few places, they are actually allowed to put together a lot of different, information from different places. They're one of the only ones. Doctor's report would be another one. Doctors usually complain that they don't have the time to see patients because they have to write reports. Well, imagine if the conversation was recorded and put automatically into a report that was pre-filled out. And so after a doctor have seen five patients, he would go in front of a computer and just do the remains of the five reports. All right. There are people who looked into what it helps businesses to do a data-driven decision-making. And that is a hard bargain to get. But they looked into 179 businesses. They could see that, when they corrected for reverse causality and things like that, the general level was 5 to 6%. So you can improve things. I think that's, again, what's the uncertainty in this? I think the answer is it's good to look at your data, but don't expect the miracles. So, but you can read this yourself. Then which methods to use? Well, there are quite a few methods out there. So let me just repeat the tree learning comes closest to meeting the requirement as serving of an off-the-shelf procedure for data mining. But they are seldom accurate, which means most performant. And that's Trevor Hasty, one of the godfathers of machine learning. So the following paper tried to look into all of this, and just note, again, it's 2014, so it's medium old by machine learning standards. And they took really a lot of methods and a lot of data samples and tried to see how well they could do. And here is some of the data samples. And you can see there's how many examples did they have, how many variables, how many classes, and which percentage was in the largest class. So this was all classification problems. Yeah, have a look. As you probably notice, the number of cases is, by machine learning standards, really, really small. And the one with by far the most cases is a particle physics experiment. You know, all the others are in the hundreds, where I would say that already doesn't invalidate the study, but certainly makes it less fitting. Here's their abstract, way too long abstract, but let's subdivide it. First of all, they said, we know we have 179 methods, but they fall in 17 families, among which neural networks, decision trees, boosting, and random forest were taken into account. And it turned out that in general, it was a random forest that was the best. And I think that is because the samples were really small. But tree-based does match a lot of these. And then it just says, all of these are put in, tree-based were 3 out of the top 5. And neural networks were also in the top, and boosting. And all of these things are put in both Python and R. There is no machine learning algorithm which is not put into Python immediately as a package. And often they're written by computer scientists in C++ to be fast and compiled and then interfaced with a package. And I think that's one of the strengths of Python. This just include whatever others have done in other languages, compiled and fast, and then use it in Python. Yeah, never mind that. And you can look at the results in more detail because it's not obvious. How do you rank them? Is it winning maximum accuracy, or is it getting in the top 95% or in the top 5%, or being 95% accuracy on as many data sets as possible? All right. Please. This was the end of machine learning two, and I will stop it here. But first, questions. Please write or tell me if anything is unclear. I know that this is just for the fun of it, so there's nothing of this is for curriculum. But yeah. No? All right, I'll stop sharing. And then I want to make a short note on binning. Because, well, I've seen... Ah, okay. Jakob asks, do you know of any machine learning methods for smaller sample sizes? Yes, I would actually say that here, random forests... are probably quite good. And I would certainly stick to tree-based learning, because tree-based learning seems to be doing reasonably well even with small samples. And instead of having one tree learning a lot, the random forest will make maybe 5 really small trees, which will then start voting. And this is a good way of sort of multiplying knowledge that you have from just a small looking at a sub problem of the case. So yeah, I think I would recommend that. But the trouble is always that you need to take some of the samples and put aside as your test set and use some of it for validation. And then you can do the cross validation to get most out of it. And with small samples, it should be fast enough. Any other questions? No? Otherwise, don't hesitate in returning to it. But notes on binning. So I've mentioned it before, and I know that some of you occasionally have... well, when you develop code, you often don't put a lot of emphasis on getting the binning right. But I want to at least discuss it because I think it's super healthy to just immediately have an idea of what should I consider. So when you produce a histogram, you have to consider the binning. And that means the range and the number of bins. And unfortunately, I would say Matplotlib does not force you to make any choices. That's, of course, nice. You just write plot and they will have to think of a binning. But it's really, really, really important to do. You can cheat yourself a lot. And data can be very tricky because several features may make your life hard. And there are many things to consider. Now, first of all, is the data discrete or not? And you might think that most data is continuous, but that's not true because most data, for example, the data from the table length, well, that is a result of you measuring, and very few did it to sub millimeters, and many of you rounded. So that is very much a discrete data set, even if it's a continuous size. And also electronics, for example, the voltage measurements down in first lab with the ball on incline, well, that looked continuous. Sure, it was continuous because it was allowed 4,096 channels. But again, it's read out with electronics that needs to digitize. And because of that, it becomes not continuous. It may look fine, but it's not continuous. And it may seem trivial, and things are continuous, of course they are, But sometimes they're not, and oftentimes more so than not, I would say. And if you have integer values only, then make sure that you make bins from I, where I is an integer, minus a half, to I plus a half. Why? Well, let's say that it's dice rolls that you have to put a histogram of. Then you might say, I'm going to make a, well, I'm going to think about binning. I'm going to make it from 0 to 6 and make the bin width 1. But it turns out that then your first bin is going to be from 0 to 1. And so the mean of that bin is not 1, even though it's 1s you're putting in. The mean of that bin, the middle of it, is a half. And that means that if you're fitting it with a binomial, it's going to cheat you by that half, or you're going to cheat yourself by that half, because usually it uses the center of the bin. And also, the bin from 1 to 2, unless everything goes well, and typically it does, then it's not clear, is that a bin where the 1s go into or where the 2s go into? And if there are numerical instabilities, then you might get both the 1s and the 2 into such a bin. If you made the range from 1/2 to 6.5 with 6 bins, then the first bin would be from 1/2 to 1.5. And it would be no doubt where the middle is and where the 1s go, and nothing else gets in there. I admittedly slightly mocked my French PhD supervisor for saying this, and came back a few weeks later apologizing, because it actually turned out that, of course, you had to do this, and it was smart, and I hadn't done it before. All right. If discrete, then you have to make sure you understand the discreteness and plot things accordingly. And also, you need to consider if you need to include all the data. It might be that, for example, for the test beam data, that you want to look at a specific small thing. Well, then you might only want to plot it in that range, but you should make the reader aware that you are cutting that range. And it's healthy to write something like, I start out by with 162,000 entries, and I plot them between 100 and 160, and in that plot are 32,000, whatever. You know, give the numbers. Also consider if you have several categories and if you can put them into the same histogram, and if it makes sense. And ensure that your binning is made reasonable, right? Make the bin size 0.1 and not 1/7 or so. And then consider the amount of statistics, you know, how fine a binning should you make, and also consider the size of the features of the data. If the data varies quickly within 0.1, then probably if you have enough statistics, you need to make it smaller so that the bin size is significantly smaller than the size of the features in the data. Should the y-axis be linear? Should the x-axis, will an insert plot be worthwhile? Should you transform the data? It turns out that machine learning algorithms loves to give things between 0 and 1, making a super sharp peak at 0 and 1 at 1. But there are transformations that takes it out of that and makes it much more Gaussianly. And that means that you can suddenly see the detail of what completely disappears if you don't transform it. And I haven't spoken about style or choice of colors or legend or axis or titles or anything else to consider. So this was just a small overview. But let's take an example. What does it look like? Well, I tried to make some data. Here's 1,000,000 points. And I put a small, well, it's this line. And then I do 2 things to it. I smear it a little bit, and I make discretize it. and that looks innocent, but let's have a look at it. So it's discrete, and it has a long tail and a smeared, and it has a peak somewhere. In summary, that is a nightmare. But typically, you know, that's not unlike for data to be. So let's try to dive in. I just tell Python, please plot it. And here is what I get. A really useful plot showing me absolutely nothing. A straight disaster in plotting. So this is an example of what you get if you don't think. I think the only thing Python got right here was cutting it at zero, but I'm not even sure it cuts. I don't think it cuts it at zero. Exactly. And doesn't write the bin width here, and yeah, well, all things are disasters. So then you might say, let's try a log plot. Yeah, here's a log x-axis, really useful. A log y-axis, super. Log both. All right. I hope you agree with me that a little more thought needs to go into this. Nothing came out useful here. So nothing worked and the plots are downright useless. So the next thing I notice is that most of the data is at very low values. So I start out by plotting just a small range up to 10, right? And the highest value is about 1 million. So that's just up to 10. And I chose this, and maybe I should have chosen 101 bins from minus to 10. Because I also want to see, are there negative values? And it turns out that there are just a few negative values. Well, it's a few thousand negative values, but nothing large. But that's also, you can imagine what the log plot, how it felt with negative values. Okay, so at least now I can see this data. And this data contains more than 90% of all data. And I can see it's a smooth drop off, maybe something around here and maybe something down here, I don't know. And now I try again with the log plot and I put it here. And once I only consider data above some value, then the log plot works. So by using these two plots, I can actually plot all the data. Here, I just go from 3 to 3 million because then I contain all the data. I can show the highest value, I can show each of it, and that it doesn't seem to have any features here. And if it does, well, then people can look into it. You can see all the data now. And yeah, there you go. So choosing a binning range really solves the problem quite well, but it's not really solved yet. But now at least you can see the general distribution. But what is that small peak in the middle? You know, is there something around here? Let me try to plot a small range in here. So I do that. And well, I even make a fit. I just took a constant plus a Gaussian. Yeah, I don't know it's constant, but well, probably that needs to be improved, but at least I see, okay, I get something, but what the hell are all these spikes? There are 6 spikes in this. Well, those are bins where the discrete data underneath tends to fall with 2 of the discrete values, which have a certain number of counts here, but only 1 here. And then 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. And then they are out of phase again, slowly shifting over here, and then again and again. And this is a classic binning problem. Your alarm should immediately be raised. What is going on here? Well, you should know that this is discrete data, and that you should bin it accordingly. How do you find out the discreteness? Well, I try to do the same thing where I choose 20,000 bins here. And well, there are a lot of empty bins. And then now I can see exactly how many bins here. And there turn out to be 206 unique bins. So now I bin it with 206 bins. And things disappear. Well, 206 bins also because here there were 6 bins that had too much in them. So six more fixes it. There are still jumps up and down, but that's what we expect from data, especially when it's around 40 entries. But at 40 entries, this is nice because, well, the Poisson error, the Gaussian approximation works really well. And how did I find out the amount of empty bins? Well, actually here, I don't care about the empty bins. I just care about how many filled bins do I have? Because if I, out of 20,000, have 206 filled bins, then I know that when I go to 206 bins, there's going to be a one-to-one correspondence in putting these in. I hope that answers your question. So now, and it turns out that also it's a falling spectrum, so the flat line is not really good. I should at least give it a slope. I haven't done that yet. And is it sort of curving as shown here? Probably it is, but probably not to a degree that can be measured at this point. So probably a sloped line and the peak does well. So, and that means in this case, I would do a chi-square fit, right? Because all the bins have enough statistics that the Gaussian approximation is good. And then a chi-square, first of all, gives a goodness of measure for the fit. And secondly, it converges more easily. So in conclusion, I'm just going to repeat what I said before, namely the fact that, well, you have to consider binning. And, well, make sure you don't make the mistake of just plotting without binning. You may do a first time you want to see something, but you should immediately, shouldn't show plots outside of your own code where you haven't given any thought to binning. And I hope that the example I just gave is sort of a reminder of that, and see how bad things can go. And then I return to this plot that I showed a long time ago. And again, here people said, all right, it's nice, it has two colors and everything. But notice how the bin width here is not the same. Python chose a different bin width because there's more statistics in one of the samples. And now suddenly they are much harder to compare. Yeah, any questions? Any further questions? No? Well, I will then try to further entertain you this morning by just making a few more notes on machine learning, just because we have it around. So I would say, there is a comment, it seems. Now I removed the chat. One question, please, Jakob. Ask out loud or write.
Okay. Yeah, okay, I'll just ask it out. It was because I saw on the Wikipedia site that there's a few methods like with some degree of mathematical, you know, foundance, suggesting how many bins there should be. Like the classical one was the square root of the number of bin number of count of statistics. And then I saw other people like treating this as like an optimization problem with like varying the bin size with the statistics and all. And I was just wondering if that is something that is done or that you know of or anything.
Yeah, I know of. And that's actually going back to here, consider the amount of statistics, but also the size of the features. So I can make a case where you would do what you just said, which would not show the features of the data. So it's a crude rule. It's a good rule of thumb. But I can easily make things that break it. For example, in this case, in the case we just had, that breaks it. Because if you, there is a million entries, right? And if you put a million entries into this data, well, first of all, if you don't divide it in two, it's never going to work, right? We saw that. And even if you have 1,000 bins here, which is what the rule would suggest, it would be too wide for it to see this Gaussian peak. It would not see it. It would take a bin from here to here. So I think it's a good rule of thumb, but to be taken with a grain of salt. I hope that answers your question. Cool, but I love that you start looking around. Who looked at this before? Amelia asks if I will go through the problem set at some point. Yes, I will. That is on for next Friday. We would like to return the problem sets before I go through them. Yeah. Any other questions? No. All right. Then let's talk about a few more things in machine learning for the next couple of minutes. So first of all, there's the problem of combining machine learning answers. It turns out that if you do a problem, and in this case, it was predicting the value of a house, of housing. Well, we tried a whole range of algorithms here, as you can see. And here is the correlation between the answers. So if one said that the house was very valuable, did the other do the same thing? And you can see some of them here, like AdaBoost and XGBoost, they almost give the same answer, and decision tree as well. And some of these Extreme Random Forest and XGBoost also gave quite the same answers. There's also a remarkable uncolored line, which is the K nearest neighbor algorithm. That simply asks, you know, the houses that looks most like this in some space, how valuable were they? Let me do an average of that. So, but it turned out that, see, correlations are very much driven by the outliers, just like the root mean square, right? If you're far away, then you really count a lot. So we tried to do the same plot, but where the model predictions were just within 50% of the true value. And suddenly the correlations go down a lot. There's still some that are quite correlated, but hey, not more than that. And then we looked at how much can you improve the predictions from the worst to the best by adding other methods. And the very good methods you could only improve very little on, of course. But the fact that you can still improve means that one algorithm got a little better at one part of the data and another on another part of the data, and they were not completely correlated. And then you can combine them. And you can combine them in a simple manner, which is, say, a linear combination. And then you can optimize saying, you know, where is the best predictor as a function of what weight I give each of them. So that's one way of doing it, and you just maximize your performance. It might also be that you simply put them into a new tree where you say, well, the inputs are all the outputs of all the other methods. And then you put that into a new algorithm. And this is called an ensemble learning. So an ensemble method will say, well, I make several algorithms here that makes predictions, and you could either just have them simply vote, but also you could just say, well, I give those four values and make a prediction based on that, or you could actually give all those four values plus the original input parameters and let them vote. And the reason why giving the original input parameters might help things is that if this one is good for, I don't know, high energy or low energy, or big houses or small houses, or Copenhagen apartments, or, you know, a special type of cancer. And this one for a different one and this one, and you from the original can know where are we in the problem set. Well, then the combination gets stronger because it knows who to rely on mostly. So that was one thing. And then just for the fun of it, I think I want you to see generative adversarial networks. So the idea of an adversarial network and generative adversarial network, and I'll explain what it is, comes from a guy called Ian Goodfellow. He's the young guy of the leading people in machine learning. And Yann LeCun, who's one of the godfathers, a French guy, he says it's the coolest idea in machine learning for the past 20 years. Maybe that's pushing it, but it is a good idea. The thing is, you want to generate something, an image or a piece of data, and you already have some data. How do you generate something that looks like the original data, the original image, whatever? Well, you ask another network to try to make a difference between what you generated and the original data. So you have two networks that compete against each other, one that generates and one that discriminates. And it's a little bit like playing crooks and police, right? The generative network is like a counterfeiting company making fake notes. And the adversarial network is like the police saying, I can see the difference, I can see the difference. You go to jail, they come out again, they try again. They're better now because they know that this was not good. And they keep doing it and keep changing their methods until the point where they produce the best they can. So this is quite useful, and I'll show you the use. So here's a drawing of it. You start from random noise, and then you make a generation. It might be of handwritten numbers, but this is a fake image. And here you have a lot of handwritten numbers already. And then the discriminator has to say, is this fake or is it real? Can I see the difference? And notice the drawing, how this one starts from numbers and makes an image, and this one starts from image and makes a number. And then it penalizes the generator. Well, am I doing good or not, right? Remember, this was called the loss function. If I'm doing good, then it's because I make a, I can cheat the discriminator, and if I'm doing bad, then it's because I can't. And NVIDIA has been one of the leaders. Thanks for the reference, Anya. Exactly posting this in the chat is why I save the chat, because then people can return to it. So thanks a lot. And the idea, I think, is quite smart. You want the generator, and this is quite general. You say, I have a loss function. I want to minimize something. Well, instead of using that, how about I use what I have as a loss function and then add an adversarial term, a penalty term. One where I say, well, if I don't do perfectly, then it's going to cost me. And I can just, with a parameter lambda, crank up the penalty. And you might think, okay, but that goes for images. No. Imagine that you have back in the courtroom an algorithm for deciding if people should go on bail or not. Well, if the adversarial can tell anything about race or religion or ethnicity or sexuality, then it penalizes the algorithm. And this way you can force an algorithm to not look at something simply by penalizing it. So the idea is quite smart, just penalize. And it's very, very, very equivalent to the chi-square, which I'll talk about next week, where you can say, I have a chi-square, but I add an additional term that penalizes if one parameter goes far away from what I know it is. And just quickly, Usually you boil images down to a latent space and then you can reconstruct from that. And that has many funny features. Could I elaborate on how it's penalized? Yeah. Well, the generator here, this term is the entire loss function. But let's say the loss function in the courtroom that I said before for bail is simply to have the smallest amount of reoffenders given a fixed fraction you sent back into society on bail, right? You want the smallest fraction of reoffenders. Well, then it turns out maybe it can do really, really well. But that was because it looked at exactly all the things we don't want it to look at, like sexuality, like ethnicity, like all of these things. Well, if another network, the adversarial network, can discriminate and say, I can tell a difference between those you put on bail and those you put back to jail, well, then I'm going to penalize you for that. Maybe this term is big, like 50. And then what it originally considered the best solution will suddenly not be the best solution because of this penalty term. Well, then it will have to find a way where it does not look at ethnicity, sexuality, and so on, because otherwise it's not the best, you could say. I hope that was enough elaboration. I don't want to keep you forever. I'm going to skip immediately to try. Thanks, René, again for all the details. Machine learning is at least one whole other course. I would say probably several. The result is that they can generate images. You just find a lot of images on the web, and then you add all of these together and see if you can make something that you can't recognize. And all of these six images are people who never existed. Well, then you might say, well, what's up with the ear? Is that part of the background here or not? Maybe there's a strange thing up here, over here with the hair. But by now, they've gone, you know, to become amazingly good. And so by now, if you have an image, then you better consider whether a lot of this type of images exist, because if they do, it might just be generated. I'm not going to say more about this here. I think it's time to cut it. And I think we should take a good long break. So let's return in the exercises at 10:30. And I probably won't be there in the exercises to begin with. But please continue and gather momentum for questions. And I hope that me and the TAs will be able to answer all of those before we call it a weekend. Yeah, enjoy and see you.